Hi, y'all. I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and this is The Takeaway, a reminder. It's been more than 2 years since Aurora, Colorado police put Elijah McClain in a chokehold and injected him with a sedative during an arrest. McClain lost consciousness, was hospitalized, and was later removed from life support. But now,
grand jury has indicted three officers and two paramedics in the death of Elijah McClain. He's the 23-year-old black man who was put in a chokehold.
It's been nearly 18 months since Greg and Travis McMichael pursued, shot, and killed Ahmaud Arbery as he was taking a jog in a neighborhood in South Georgia. But now,
the former district attorney of Brunswick, Georgia, facing an indictment in connection to her actions surrounding the Ahmaud Arbery investigation.
And although the public only recently learned about it, it's been more than 2 years since Louisiana State Police troopers brutalized and killed Ronald Green during a routine traffic stop. But now,
in video obtained, released, and edited by the Associated Press, the brutal and violent arrest and subsequent death of Ronald Green is captured on body camera.
If justice delayed is indeed justice denied, then we must ask, is justice possible in any of these cases? Or the hundreds of others that never make the headlines? If there's one person I know who could help me respond to this question, it's attorney Ben Crump. He's been the attorney for a lot of high-profile cases, including Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and the town of Flint, Michigan, and is attorney to Ahmaud Arbery as well. Mr. Crump, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa. It's such an honor to be with you.
Can you explain to our audience just a little bit about the steps along the long road when someone is unjustly killed, maybe particularly in cases of racist violence or state violence? What does it take to get some kind of indictment, some kind of accountability?
Well, Melissa, when you think about the killings of marginalized people of color by police or quasi-authoritative figures who are not people of color, when you have an unarmed black person killed by a white police officer, you often see we have to go through extraordinary lengths to be able to just get simple justice, to get due process. Obviously, we all think back, and it's hard to believe, Melissa, it's almost 10 years coming up on the killing of Trayvon Benjamin Martin, 17 years old, walking home where he was profile pursued and shot in his heart by the neighborhood watch volunteer who had a 9mm gun. And it was there that I first started telling everybody, when you're black and you're killed by a non-black person in America, you have to fight in two courts. First, you have to fight in the court of public opinion. And then if you win there, then just maybe, you might get a chance to have your day in the court of law. No guarantee, because we saw with Eric Garner, we all won the court of public opinion, but yet his family, his mother, Ms. Gwen Carr, they still have never got their day in court.
In what places is it necessary for a grand jury? So one of the things that we see so often is that local prosecutors will say, well, we've got to take this to a grand jury for indictment, and then we'll hear that there is, that the grand jury has decided not to indict. But in other places, it seems like the DA, the prosecutor, simply indicts. What are we missing as a public on this?
Well, you know, what I believe it is, Melissa, and I write about it in my book, Open Season, The Legalized Genocide of Colored People. It is this notion, this concept of the intellectual justification of discrimination. The prosecutor who often do not want to charge these police officers when they kill people in our community unjustly, they will come up with ways to try to not administer justice as they're supposed to. And what they often do is say, well, we don't have enough evidence to create probable cause to charge the person. So we're going to turn it over to a grand jury. And if the grand jury doesn't indict them, doesn't come back with a true bill, then we're going to say, well, we left it up to the people of the community, and they made the decision, which is such ridiculousness, because what we all know is that they can prosecute a ham sandwich if they want to. Literally, Melissa, it is so deep that they get the grand jury to return indictments on 99.99999% of the time. But Melissa Harris Perry, when it's a white police officer killing a black person, then that number is reversed. It's almost as if they can never get an indictment. Even when you have video and such, all kind of objective evidence, they say, oh, well, the grand jury didn't come back for an indictment. And what they failed to tell you is the grand jury is made up of lay citizens, and they're the only lawyer in the room. And so it's whatever that prosecutor wants them to do, they're going to do. And that's why it's so heartbreaking as we continue to fight for the family of Breonna Taylor, because you had Daniel Cameron, the African-American attorney general, the Republican attorney general, who went in that grand jury room. And even when members of the community asked questions about, can we even consider charges of murder against these police officers for shooting down this unarmed young black woman in her own apartment, he told them no. That decision had already been made based on the law that they couldn't charge, which is a perfect example of the power that the prosecutor wears in the grand jury box. So we got to call BS when they come and say, oh, well, the grand jury failed to return an indictment. That's because you gave them information to reach that conclusion.
Speaking of exactly that point, the former district attorney in Brunswick, Georgia, Jackie Johnson, is now facing an indictment herself connected to the actions surrounding the Ahmaud Arbery investigation. Can you say a few words on that?
Certainly. My co-counsel, Attorney Lee Merritt, and I, we applaud the efforts of Chris Carr, the Georgia Attorney General, for coming back with this indictment, and the grand jury having all the information to see that this prosecutor gave more respect and gave more consideration to the murderers, the lynch mob who chased Ahmaud Arbery down and lynched him for jogging while black. And what Jackie Johnson did was, even though she saw that video on day one, the same video that we saw, 72 days later, she made a decision that she was going to try to help her friend, former police officer Gregory McMichaels, who with his son Travis McMichaels hunted Ahmaud Arbery down like a dog in the street, and we saw killed him with that shotgun, those two shotgun wounds. And so what we often see is prosecutors put their thumbs on the scale of justice, whether it was, you know, the prosecutors in Michael Brown case in Ferguson. Obviously, we just talked about Breonna Taylor, but then you saw with Ahmaud Arbery. Had that video not come out, she never would have charged the killers. But even worse than that, she obstructed justice by talking to the person who she was going to refer the case to once she came up with this alleged conflict of interest. And so it was almost like a conspiracy that we believe was going on to make sure that the killers of Ahmaud Arbery were never going to be brought to justice. And so this should be a precedent for these prosecutors who, for decades, Melissa Harris Perry, have always tried to make sure justice was denied to black people in America.
Now, I know that you are not officially representing the family of Elijah McClain, but I want to talk about just one aspect of that case out of Aurora, Colorado, because one of the things that police used in their and have been using in their conversation around that is excited delirium. It's also language that we heard in other recent cases, and it sounds like such a official medical psychological term. Can you talk about it a little bit?
It is one of the most asinine concepts that I have ever heard of when you think about it. This excited delirium theory is this concept that says once the police put you in the chokehold or the police put you in a prone position, then if you have, and you die, and if you've ever once used cocaine in your life, they try to say, oh, well, you have a history of cocaine use. It could be 20 years ago or what have you, Melissa. They then try to say, oh, the cause of death is not what you see on that video with the police having his knee in the person's back and them being handcuffed. The cause of death is unrelated to the acts of the police. The cause of death is going to be this concept that the police experts, people who testify for police on a regular basis, have developed, and the courts over time have adopted as actual science, even though there isn't sufficient data or testing to be able to prove that this concept really exists. It's like, if it was for real, I believe, Melissa, we should see people just walking down the street falling out dead based on this concept that, oh, if you use cocaine once, it can cause stress on your heart, and unbeknownst to anybody, it can cause you just to die. I mean, it. The only time they cite excited delirium as a cause of death is in police in custody deaths. Nowhere else do they cite this. And again, it's just the prosecutor's attempt to justify the unjustifiable actions of excessive force by police officers. And it goes back to Jackie Johnson, who I say very profoundly, she did not pull the trigger to kill Ahmaud Arbery, but she played a starring role in the cover-up. And that's what happens so many times with excited delirium. Even though the prosecutors did not put their knee in the back, didn't do, you know, these terrible physical acts to these unarmed black people who they killed, but the prosecutor will then come and be the start of the cover-up. They will tell the police, we got you. We're going to make sure that you get a get-out-of-jail-free pass card. You have so many dynamics going together, Melissa Harris-Perry, to be able to allow the police to kill us legally, whether it's excited delirium, whether it's qualified immunity, the United States Supreme Court doctrine that says all the police have to say when they kill us, no matter how unreasonable and how much objective evidence we have, all they have to say is three little words. I felt fear. I felt threatened. And then the Supreme Court say, oh, you can't Monday morning quarterback the police. You weren't there. And if they felt this subjective fear, then everything is justified. Even though, yet again, we have another black man running away, shot in the back. And we're going to say the police didn't use excessive force.
Attorney Ben Crump, thank you so much for always being a companion on that long road to justice. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Continue to use your voice for the voiceless and to uplift our culture.
So how do organizers and activists ensure sustained media attention and public pressure demanding victims are not forgotten and assailants are held accountable? Scott Roberts is Senior Director of Criminal Justice Campaigns for Color of Change, the nation's largest online racial justice organization. Scott, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So talk to me a little bit about how we take these stories that sometimes are 18 months, 2 years, sometimes even longer than that, when they first come into our public consciousness. How do we sustain momentum around them?
Yeah, this is a great question. I'm glad we're talking about this today. You know, within organizing within kind of the world of campaign strategy around these cases for justice, we talk a lot about the drumbeat, you know, keeping up a steady flow of communication, of action around these cases, keeping them at the top of mind, making sure that they are, that we're making interventions in our political system around these cases. I think that oftentimes, you know, especially for those of us who are following at the national level, these cases look like, you know, there's a short attention span around them, right? You know, national media, even to an extent, national organizations like my own, you know, show up, talk about these things when they are, when they've captured the national consciousness. But the reality is, on the ground locally, the families, local activists and organizations are involved in really long fights that can be really drug out over, as you said, months, years. And I think, you know, one of the core tenets is sending a clear message to the community that we're not going to be able to move on, get back to business as usual until there's some justice here in these cases. And so you see folks using lots of tactics that are really visible, showing up in places. In Los Angeles, where a former prosecutor, I heard you on earlier with Ben Crump talking about the power of prosecutors in these, you know, in these cases and in these fights for justice for people who have been victims of these types of violence. In Los Angeles, Black Lives Matter showed up weekly at former prosecutor Jackie Lacey's office, demanding that she prosecute a number of cases, right? Keeping those cases at the forefront.
I think that's, it's an interesting strategic point, right? That on one hand, you could see local organizations, activists mobilized on that kind of drumbeat weekly basis. But I'm also thinking about that national, you know, you've kind of played out for us this local versus national. From a strategic perspective, right, we just know that national media isn't going to stay on any one story, right, in that kind of weekly drumbeat. Are there key moments kind of in that road to justice or at least accountability when national organizations like Color of Change or national media are most useful, like maybe the indictment phase or the sentencing phase? I'm just wondering if there are, if there's strategy around that mobilization.
Yeah, I think we try to create a lot of moments. And this is, you know, part of what I wanted to get to is that, you know, that yes, there are these stages around the case, like you said. There's indictment, grand jury. There are the release of videos, things like that. That's often really a peak moment in attention, right? When there's a visual for people to see, to get clarity on, or to debate, you know, what they're seeing, whether the case is going to be up front. When the case is starting, you know, during the course of the George Floyd case, you know, we had, you know, 24-hour monitoring, basically, of what was happening, trying to keep people informed online. You know, we thought about it almost like the O.J. Simpson case, right? And that we knew that people would be paying close attention to it as an opportunity to not only keep the focus on the case, but on the overall issues that are being brought up. I think there's also other moments like that are celebratory or commemorative, right? So the birthday of the person, the anniversary of their passing, right? These are the moments where we try to push them back into the national conversation for sure. And then we try to create moments, you know? So there may be, say for instance, in the case of Breonna Taylor, local activists and we collaborated with these folks, you know, just taking moments that are normally part of the story of Louisville, like the Kentucky Derby, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. And trying to turn it into a moment that's about Breonna Taylor by showing up at the protest. We flew a plane banner over the Kentucky Derby, right? So also just inserting this story into those other kind of national moments that spotlight these cities and these communities.
When you mentioned the birthday of the person who's been victimized, help us understand the difference between keeping the victim and their story, their reality at the center, without making sort of just the moment of their death the only thing that we know about them.
Right. We believe in a Black joy approach to this work, even though we're dealing with devastating, heartbreaking cases many times. We want to celebrate the person's life. We want to for lack of a better word, humanize them, right? Because so often the opposition, the forces that are anti-accountability, are trying to demonize, criminalize these individuals. So when we get to lift up their birthday, we get to tell the story of their life, right, rather than their death. And I think that's incredibly important to keeping people engaged, keeping people demanding justice, and, you know, reminding us that why we're fighting in the first place, because we want to defend the lives of Black people against racist and state sanctioned violence.
What is your one piece of advice for folks who might be frustrated about the stories that have fallen out of the news, where they're like, but I really want to know what happens next there, and I want to impact and affect it?
Well, I will go back to my original point, you know, that there are, I promise you, there are local activists, the families, there are local journalists, attorneys that are all sticking on these cases. They're being persistent. They're determined to see justice. And I would find them. I think on social media is one of the best tools. Finding those local activists who are focused on those individual cases, they will give you actions you can take, things that you can do, even as the cases fade from the national spotlight.
Scott Roberts is Senior Director of Criminal Justice Campaigns for Color of Change. Thank you for joining us, Scott.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.